Thunderhead. Local residents didn't know what it was, and the cars and trucks on Highway 77 drove right through it. Air Force security police soon evacuated the roughly 200 inhabitants of Rock. Sergeant Thomas had been left behind, and none of the PTS crew members felt right about that. Even though he was gone, they thought, he shouldn't be lying down there alone. Two men volunteered to get him. Merle Linthicum, the team chief trainee, and Airman John G. Korzenko. They returned to the launch complex and put on Refco suits. Linthicum climbed into the escape hatch first, followed by Korzenko. Within seconds, Korzenko had climbed out. Oxidizer was leaking into his suit. Linthicum came back moments later. He wasn't getting enough air in his helmet. Another PTS team arrived from McConnell with fresh Refco suits and air packs. They wanted to get Thomas out, too. Airman Midland R. Jackson put on a Refco and climbed into the escape hatch. He came right back. His helmet was leaking. Jackson grabbed another helmet, tried the escape hatch again, and climbed the ladder all the way to the bottom in his Refco. But he'd never been in the escape hatch before, and the oxidizer was so thick down there he couldn't find the entrance to the control center. He climbed back up the ladder, frustrated, and yet determined not to quit. A few minutes later, Jackson and two other PTS technicians in Refcos, Technical Sergeant John C. Mock and Airman Michael L. Greenwell, tried to enter the control center through the access portal. They wandered underground through dense clouds of oxidizer, literally feeling their way down the stairs and through blast doors. They could not see more than a foot or so ahead, and had to stick together because none of their radios worked. They made it to the control center, found Sergeant Thomas on the floor, and carried his body onto the elevator. But no matter how many times they pushed the buttons, the elevator wouldn't work. They decided to carry Thomas up the stairs. His body was heavy, their suits felt heavy, and it was hot down there. After a few minutes, they couldn't carry him any farther and had to leave his body on the stairs. Two more PTS technicians in Refcos, Sergeant James Romig and Airman Gregory W. Anderson, went down and carried him, then had to quit because of the heat. The five men took turns going into the complex and carrying Thomas as far as they could. As soon as one group got tired, the other would step in. It took 2 hours to get Thomas up the stairs and out of the complex. An investigation of the accident later found the cause of the leak. Someone hadn't put a filter inside the oxidizer line. But the small rubber O-ring designed to hold the filter had been left inside the line. The O-ring blocked the poppet valve from closing fully, allowing oxidizer to pour out. Nobody accepted responsibility for failing to insert the filter. Oxidizer flowed more quickly without a filter in place, and someone may have deliberately omitted the filter to save time and load the tank quickly. The blast door leading to the control center wouldn't open because someone had propped open the blast door across from it with a bungee cord, and both doors couldn't be open at the same time. Hepstall had used the manual override to unlock Blast Door 8, and by entering the control center, he'd contaminated it with oxidizer. Robert J. Thomas was killed by a leak in his Refco, most likely at the spot where it intersected with the left glove. Oxidizer may have poured into the suit as he tried to reconnect the line to the missile. The Air Force recommended in the future that black vinyl electrical tape be used to seal the interface between the glove and the Refco suit more securely. Thomas left a widow and two young sons. Irby Hepstall died a week and a half later, at the age of 22, his lungs destroyed by oxidizer. His son had just turned 2. A small tear in the left leg of Hepstall's Refco suit, about 7/8 of an inch long, had allowed oxidizer to enter it. Carl Malinger had a stroke, went into a coma, suffered lung and kidney damage, lost the use of his left arm, and spent the next several months in the hospital. He'd enlisted to get training as an automobile mechanic, and his mother later felt enormous anger at the Air Force. Its report on the accident said that Hepstall and Malinger had failed to comply with Technical Order 21M LGM25C212, which states if disconnect starts to leak, screw disconnect to fully connected position immediately. The report suggested that Malinger, never trained for the task and working in a Titan II silo for the first time, was somehow to blame for what happened. General Curtis LeMay had created an institutional culture at the Strategic Air Command that showed absolutely no tolerance for mistakes. People were held accountable not only for their behavior, but for their bad luck. To err is human, everyone at the command had been told. To forgive is not SAC policy. Blaming young enlisted men for the accident at Rock, Kansas didn't eliminate the problems with the Titan II. The Pentagon had announced in 1967 that the Titan II was no longer needed and would be decommissioned, with the first missiles coming off alert in 1971. But every year the Air Force successfully battled to keep the Titan II. Its warhead was more than 7 times more powerful than the warhead carried by the Minuteman II. The United States had about 1,000 land-based missiles, and the 54 Titan IIs represented roughly 1/3 of their total explosive force. SAC didn't want to lose all that megatonnage without getting new weapons to replace it. As the Titan II aged, however, its ability to reach the Soviet Union became more uncertain. The last test launch of a Titan II occurred in 1976, and no more were planned due to a shortage of missiles and parts. When Senator Pryor and Skip Rutherford visited a Titan II site in Arkansas, the place looked impressive. But one of Rutherford's confidential sources later told him that there had been an oxidizer leak at a nearby launch complex that day, and that the vapor detectors in 13 of the state's 18 silos were broken. Pryor came up with a relatively inexpensive plan for protecting rural communities from fuel and oxidizer leaks at Titan II missile sites. Install a siren at every complex that would blare whenever the crew turned on the red warning beacon topside. The siren could easily be mounted on the same pole. It would warn neighboring homes and farms of a leak. The Air Force opposed the idea, arguing that a siren might cause people to leave areas of safety and evacuate into or through areas containing propellant fumes. Colonel Richard D. Osborne told Pryor that during those rare occasions when civilians